Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, December 4th, 2014. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Neil Walker from the Campaign for Real Ale, or CAMRA, joins us to talk about his organization's efforts to revitalize and preserve traditional beer styles and pubs in the UK. Neil will also answer your questions from Facebook and Twitter. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're in the Google Plus, too. And thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site, especially during this really busy holiday season. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first and click on our ad on basicbrewing.com. It's on the right-hand side of the page there. It's the little Amazon logo. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we greatly, greatly appreciate your support. You've been wearing it out the past couple of weeks. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry Podcast Directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We are just everywhere. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. And thanks to everybody who has done so already. People are ordering our new Jumbo Combo from our website. This combo has all four of our DVDs, our logbook, and our bottle opener, all at one low holiday special limited time price. If you already have our stuff, the Jumbo Combo also makes a great gift for a new brewer or someone who you think needs to be a home brewer. Check that out at basicbrewingshop.com. And a reminder, it's time to get a logbook for 2015. Start the year fresh with a brand new logbook. Another reminder, it's time to send in your homebrew disaster story for our annual homebrew disaster show. Every year, Steve and I get together and we read your disastrous stories and reward you for the best ones. This year, the show will actually fall on our January 1st episode, so we'll start off the year in a disastrous way. The Brew Holler folks are back on board this year to donate prizes for this year's episode. We met them out at the National Homebrewers Conference in June, and they were disappointed that we kind of miscommunicated. They love to be a part of the disaster show. It's probably my fault for getting in touch with them too late last year. But anyway, the Brew Holler folks are donating prizes for this year's episode, and we'll probably throw in some Basic Brewing stuff in there too. So I'm setting Christmas Day as the deadline to submit your disaster story because it's easy to remember. Steve and I will get together early the week after to record the show. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag with a disastrous letter. Ira writes in from Parts Unknown and says, I had a question about yeast and sour mashing that came up after the Great Berliner episode last week, specifically with the very low pH of the sour mash boil and fermenting wort. Would the yeast still be healthy enough to harvest and repitch after a full sour mash fermentation? And would they still be viable and have retained enough of their original character to pitch into a non-sour mash brew, say a typical pale ale, or are the conditions too harsh on the yeast and should it just be tossed? So I punted the question over to Mike Tonsmeyer, author of American Sour Beers, a book that maybe you should get under your Christmas tree. Mike answered, if the beer is lightly tart, no issue. But like a high alcohol or highly hopped brew, I hesitate to reuse the yeast from a highly acidic sour mash / wort. You could likely build up a portion of the yeast in a starter to revive it, but Mike says harsh conditions could change the character of the yeast. Does that make sense? Anytime the yeast is stressed out too much, from any of those conditions that he talked about. It seems like it'd be better just to buy fresh stuff. Thanks to Ira for the question and Mike for the answer. We have a sponsor this week. This holiday season, give the gift of homebrewing. An American Homebrewers Association membership is the perfect stocking stuffer for fellow beer enthusiasts. What's more, if you purchase an AHA gift card before December 12th, 2014, you'll receive a free gift. Choose from three popular Brewers publication titles: IPA by Mitch Steele, Designing Great Beers by Ray Daniels, or Radical Brewing by Randy Mosher. Visit homebrewersassociation.org to learn more. All three of those are great books. That's homebrewersassociation.org to learn more about that. Now, let's go on to our conversation with Neil Walker from the Campaign for Real Ale. Neil Walker, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
No, thank you for inviting me along.
I guess we should start with the easiest and most obvious question. What is real ale?
Well, in terms of Camra's definition of real ale, so we're the Campaign for Real Ale, and how we define it is basically beer which is served from the vessel which it's fermented. So obviously all beer undergoes a primary fermentation, which generally happens in the brewery, and real ale actually undergoes a secondary re-fermentation, which actually happens in the pub. So it's delivered to the pub unfinished, and then it matures in the cask, and that's where its second fermentation happens. And that's basically where it gets its carbonation. So it's a much softer level of carbonation than you might expect with a force carbonated beer, which has kind of led to, you know, certain people from other countries thinking it would be, you know, a flat beer, but it's not flat. It's got a carbonation, but it's just much softer.
Yes, and in the past, Britain has a reputation for having flat, warm beer. Is that true?
I think we're slowly shedding that image. I think, as you say, you know, it is served ever so slightly warmer than you would drink it in America, but it's certainly not warm. It's served at what's known as cellar temperature, so that's typically between about 10 and 13 degrees, whereas a kegged beer would certainly be served generally between about 6 and 8 degrees. Some pubs will serve, you know, lagers much colder than that, but generally that's about right for something like an IPA. In England, we serve it about 10 to, you know, 12, 13 degrees. What that does, though, is it allows a beer which has been matured as a real ale, so it's been matured in the pub cellar as a cask beer. It allows certain, what's the best way to put it, certain nuances of flavour to come out, which you might otherwise have got lost. So I think what British real ale does so well is you can have a beer which is, you know, 4%, even, you know, less than 4%, and actually it's got masses of flavor because the temperature allows these kind of intricacies to come out, so you get a lot of complexity for a lower ABV, which is really, you know, that's where real ale really shines.
And for us Americans, that's around 50 degrees Fahrenheit as the sweet spot. You know, over here in the United States, we have our thriving craft beer movement, but we still have the vast majority of our beer that's produced over here is the yellow fizzy stuff that the big manufacturers want you to drink as cold as possible. In fact, there's a beer called Coors Light that you may have heard of, and I hope it's not available over there. But
it is available over here. Yeah, it's not one that I would drink myself, but it is certainly available. Yeah, and that, well, I'm sure, as you're about to say, that's one that's designed to be served even colder, so you can barely taste anything.
Right, exactly. In fact, they have over here, they on the labels and on the cans, they have temperature sensitive technology that where, you know, certain mountains show up on the can or something that show you that it's safe enough to drink because it's so cold.
Yeah, no, we have that over here as well. I think we probably got it a little bit later than you guys, but we in the last couple of years we have started to get that. I mean, England, you know, the same as America, and well, the whole of the UK actually. So that's England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. It is still lager that dominates, but I think what's important to remember is that the overall beer market is actually, it's in slight decline in the UK, so people are drinking less beer, but the one area of the market which is actually growing, so the one area of the market that's outperforming the rest, is real ale. So it just goes to show that, you know, craft beer and real ale, which I think are, you know, intertwined in the UK and in America, are the ones that people are drinking. So I think people are drinking less, but I think they're drinking better. When drinks are, you know, in England, we're probably paying around £4, even £5 a pint for a pint of beer in central London. You want to drink something which is high quality, and I think that real ale and craft beer plays into that. You're not willing to pay that much for something which is mass-produced and has no flavour.
And that might lead us into the history of Camera. How and when and why did it come about?
Well, Camera's been around for, well, it's about 44 years this year. It was originally set up in the 70s, basically as a reaction to the big breweries at the time, moving from a beer which was served traditionally, so it was served from the cask, generally in wooden casks, and the big breweries wanted to basically increase productivity. They wanted to use all the best modern technology that they could. So they, you know, they started to pasteurize the beer. They started to keg the beer, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But the problem was that the beer that they were doing was bad. The beer they were putting into kegs was not good, and then they were trying to sell this as a you know, a brand new technology and what everybody should be drinking. And it started to flood the UK. So, you know, we always talk about kind of Watney's Red Barrel and these sort of beers, which were everyone kind of cites as, you know, the worst ones at the time. And it really was those that were the, you know, final nail in the coffin. And people said, you know, this isn't good enough. We need to kind of hold on to our traditional beers that have got more flavor. These guys set up Camera, which was actually originally called the Campaign for the Revitalization of Ale. But it's a little bit too hard to say. So they eventually changed it to the Campaign for Real Ale, which is where the term real ale came from. You know, if you look then, there was just a couple of thousand members. We've now got 167,000 members. So it really means that Camera is one of the biggest single-issue consumer groups, well, in the world, but certainly in Europe. In terms of beer groups, Camera's got massive influence, as well as, you know, campaigning for pubs, campaigning for real ale. We also campaign for beer in general, so we're working on generic beer campaigns, you know, working alongside some of the big brewers to kind of get beer back into the public consciousness. The thing that we really promote is obviously, you know, real ale and cask beer, but we're not against anything. You know, we're not against keg beer. We're not against lager necessarily. We're not against the big brewers. But what we're saying is that this is the thing that we promote. And this is the thing that we love, really. So that kind of gives you a snapshot of how Camera started and kind of what it's become as it's grown.
I solicited questions out on Twitter and Facebook, and some of the responses I got from the Facebook page ranged from Stephen Crosby saying, considering the great British ales available, not in the U.S., why isn't Camera a no-brainer? So there, that's a positive one. And then we got a couple of negative ones. Dragos Nastasi says, what's the point of it? Is it to hold on to a tradition kind of like potter making clay pots with a man-powered wheel? And Chris Taylor says, do you see a future for an organization stuck in the past which considers the method of serving determines the quality of the beer? So how do you respond to that? How do you respond to people that say that, you know, maybe you're hanging on to something that you shouldn't be?
Yeah, I think that the thing to remember is that, you know, Camera isn't about holding on to old technology, which isn't viable nowadays. You know, it's not like saying we're doing this because it's how it used to be done. We're actually doing it because we believe that the beer tastes better. There's lots of different ways that you can serve beer. And, you know, if you go up to Germany and you taste some of the beers that they have there, the lagers and things like that, which would suit, you know, being force carbonated and would suit being kegged, then there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, actually Camera promote those styles of beer at their festival as well. But if you taste a British real ale, something which is, you know, perhaps 3.5% or up to 5%, something like a Best Bitter or even a Porter, for me personally, you know, I think that does taste better served on cask. We're not saying that the innovations in craft beer that are happening elsewhere in the market are bad. What we're saying is that, you know, we're here to hold on to this bit. We're saying that, you know, there's certain beers that really do taste better served as real ales, and it really is worth holding on to. I think sometimes it's hard to to explain to people who've only drank kegged beer, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, patronize your listeners. I'm sure they've tried loads of different beers, but you know, there's certain beers which if you try that in a bottle, you might think, well, what's this? That doesn't taste that good. But actually, if you taste that same beer, something like an English Bitter, if you tasted that on cask in really good condition, then you know it's a fantastic beer. And I think that's what it's all about. It's about preserving something which really does deliver a fantastic beer into the glass.
So it's not in the spirit of the Reinheitsgebot, the German beer purity law that says beer is this and nothing else.
No, absolutely not. I mean, if you come along to, we have hundreds of festivals all over the UK, but if you come to our biggest one, which is the Great British Beer Festival, you know, we have really unusual beers there. So, you know, for instance, we had a Welsh brewery who brought along a bacon smoked chocolate beer last year, you know, so that certainly wouldn't get past the purity law. It's not about stifling creativity. It's just about preserving the thought that certain beers are served better like that, and that actually a beer can taste better served on cask. You know, there's nothing wrong with using American hops. There's nothing wrong with using different yeasts, using different malt bills. You know, in no way is it designed to stifle any creativity. And actually, some of the best beers and some of the most unusual beers are being produced by small breweries in the UK. These microbrewers, really, really small, particularly looking at this from an American perspective, some of the breweries which are producing fantastic beer in the UK are absolutely tiny, you know, little 10-barrel plants. And we are not about, you know, stopping them producing whatever they want. We're just about kind of promoting real ale and promoting it to British people.
Ryan Murphy on Twitter says, where does Camera come down on using non-traditional brewing ingredients? So, say, spices and sugars and, you know, bacon or whatever.
Yeah. It always makes me laugh when people ask about, you know, non-traditional. Because actually, you know, nothing is new in the beer world. If you go back 100 years, 200 years, they were using spices. You know, they were using orange peel. They were using coriander. They were using different types of yeast. You know, England was importing American hops and vice versa. So it's not nothing, you know, nothing new in the beer world actually. And certainly Camera, as I've just said with, you know, answering your last question, was certainly not there to stifle creativity. And we would, you know, we celebrate it. If you go along to a Camera beer festival, there's going to be some unusual beers there. And that's a really big draw for a lot of people. Beer festivals and Camera are about trying a range of different styles and a range of different types of beer. We also have kind of specialist categories in our national competition. So for beers which don't necessarily fit into a certain style, such as, you know, bitter or porter or stout or whatever the style is, we do have a specialist category. So that could be anything from, you know, an orange wheat beer served as a real ale, or that could be, you know, anything really. So we certainly do, you know, do support different types of beer and using unusual ingredients.
I went to the Great Taste of the Midwest here in the United States a couple of years ago, and there was a tent dedicated to cask ales. And there was a lot of beer there and a lot of different styles, and I got to try a couple of them. The danger of going to one of those things is that there's so much beer to try that you don't get to try everything that you want. But so there is some enthusiasm over here as well for, you know, the cask-conditioned beers.
Yeah, I think it's a growing thing in the U.S., I mean, I've visited the US many times, and I've drank in, you know, craft beer bars, and there's some, obviously when I'm over there, I'm interested in drinking American beers and, you know, the really hoppy IPAs and things like that, which the beers that you're famous for. But certainly there's a growing contingent of people and craft beer drinkers, particularly within the US, that are interested in, you know, artisanal, really, really kind of interesting products. And I think that real ale ties into that. You know, it's the most craft of craft, isn't it? It's very small. It's very traditional. It's quite difficult to do as well. You know, you've got to hold your hands up with credit to pubs in the UK that can serve a really brilliant pint of real ale, because it's difficult to keep that beer in good condition. It's difficult to serve it at its optimum. You know, that's the reason that beer started to put into kegs, because it takes away the risk from the pub not knowing what it's doing. And I think that's obviously going to be a problem in the US as it starts to become more popular, and as pubs start to serve more real ale. You know, they've got to be trained and they've got to know how to serve it. So yeah, that's something which is hopefully going to grow in the US, and we hope to see that as well.
Matt Moore on Facebook says, "Is bottle conditioned beer considered real ale?" We as homebrewers, a lot of us bottle our beer and we put a little priming sugar in there with the beer. Theoretically, would that be considered real ale as well?
It is, yeah. I mean, we have a we actually have an initiative over here in the UK which is called Real Ale in a Bottle. And basically, that means that breweries who commercially produce beer which is re-fermented in the bottle, so it's got live yeast in the bottle, and that's where it gets its carbonation. We actually give them a badge which they can put on their bottle, directly into their artwork, and it's printed on the label, which actually says, camera says, this is real ale. So we absolutely do support that, and that's what we would refer to as real ale in a bottle. We actually have a competition as well, which is specifically for these types of beers. So if you go to the Champion Beer of Britain competition, which is the one that we run at our Great British Beer Festival, there is actually a competition within that, which is specifically for bottled real ales. So yeah, it's certainly something which we recognize.
So we homebrewers are even more cool than we thought.
Well, exactly, yeah. And the thing to remember as well is that, I talked a little bit before about the kind of small breweries and microbreweries in the UK and how they're leading the way with some really interesting beers. The vast majority of those brewers started as homebrewers. You look at some of the best breweries near where I live. So you look at breweries such as The Colonel. You look at Weird Beard Co., which is quite a funny name, but a good brewery. And a lot of these brewers actually starting off in home brewing and then, moved into doing it professionally. So it really is a good way to kind of, learn about beer and to really understand beer.
That's common over here as well. I mean, there's something about standing around a brew kettle and smelling that the wort and envisioning the final product and wanting to serve that to others that makes you want to do that for a living. And a lot of people are doing that, fortunately.
Yeah. I think there's something inherently satisfying about producing something yourself and giving it to other people, whether it's, cooking a meal or whether it's, baking a loaf of bread or brewing beer. Then giving that to another person, them enjoying that, I think that's inherently something which we all want. We all want to produce something and other people to enjoy it. And I certainly, when I've homebrewed in the past with friends, and when you try that beer or when you give that to one of your family members or whoever, and they like it, I think there's something fantastic about that. So if you can do that as a business, then you've got the best job in the world, really, haven't you?
Oh yeah, and your workplace smells pretty darn good.
Exactly.
Now, let's get into a little bit of the mechanics. Talk about the mechanics of cask fermentation or re-fermentation. How does that work for those who aren't familiar?
Yeah. So basically, as a beer is brewed in the brewery itself, so it's left to ferment. The brewer adds yeast to it, which converts the sugars. Let's start a little bit earlier. In malt, there is starches, which, while it's being brewed, actually converts into sugars. And then that's what the yeast eats, basically, to convert into alcohol and CO2, which gives the beer its carbonation. So that's in the brewery. That's its primary fermentation. Then when it's put into casks, it obviously loses that carbonation. And it's redosed with yeast. So actually, they put fresh yeast into the cask, seal it up, and then it is delivered to the pub. Then it's maturing in the pub cellar. The yeast goes to work on the beer again, and it gives it its fermentation for a second time, and that's what gives the carbonation to the finished beer. Obviously, that's a kind of very simplified version of it. Basically, that's what's happening. The yeast is breaking down the sugars in the beer and converting that into CO2, which is obviously carbonation, and also alcohol. So that's what gives beer its alcohol and gives beer its fizz or its carbonation.
So what are the methods that brewers and pub owners use to control the level of carbonation in these beers?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of the pub, what they do, they'll actually, they have valves on the actual cask, which is basically a wooden bung or a soft bung, which is in the top of the cask, and they will release that if it's bubbling too ferociously. The thing is about a barrel of beer is that you're going to have a very small amount of space, a small amount of headroom in there. It's going to be fairly full of beer. CO2 is heavier than air. So if you let a little bit out and you open it for a little bit and tap it off, the air is going to be pushed out first, which is obviously the, you know, the enemy of beer. You don't want to get air to your beer because that's what's going to make it go bad. So the CO2 will actually push the air out, and then they'll kind of put the bung back in. And it's all to do that. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. And I'm certainly not an expert in cellarmanship. But that's basically what they do, is they keep an eye on the barrels, they keep an eye on the casks, and they see how ferociously they're fermenting. If they look like they're fermenting too quickly, there's too much kind of bubbling beer coming out of the barrel, then they need to kind of release the pressure a little bit, and that's basically what they do. And they'll keep checking it until it gets to a point where they think that secondary fermentation is finished, and then probably that day or the next day it's going to be ready to serve.
So there's a bit of an art to it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and it's something which is tricky, because as real ale grows in the UK, as it becomes more and more popular, what you will get is you'll get pubs which wouldn't have previously served real ale, wanting to have it because people kind of expect it nowadays. One great example is hotels. So lots of hotels want to have real ale because it's what the guests expect, but it's very difficult to do because you don't really have a person that runs the cellar, or sometimes you don't even have a cellar. So it's quite difficult. And there's been some companies which have experimented with things such as fast cask. This is one thing which was an innovation, which basically means that it's got beads in the beer which contain the yeast. So it means that you can serve it pretty much straight away. There's not kind of loose yeast in the beer. It's actually in these kind of beads, which gives it a secondary fermentation, but it also means that the yeast drops straight away to the bottom of the barrel and you can serve it straight away. So you can deliver it, turn it over and serve it. Hmm. Normally with real ale, it needs time to clear. So if you rolled a cask of real ale down the street, delivered it to the pub, stood it up and tapped it, it would come out very cloudy. So as well as that secondary fermentation, you need time for the beer to clear and for the sediment and the yeast to drop to the bottom of the cask.
Now, since it's a naturally carbonated and you don't use CO2 to push the beer out, right?
That's right, yeah.
What are the mechanics of serving? How do you get the beer out?
So basically, what we use in the UK is we use what we call a hand pull. Well, basically, it's a beer engine. So it uses a suction capillary action, basically, if we're going to get scientific. So on the bar, you'll see the kind of old school traditional hand pulls. And what they're doing is they're physically pulling the beer through by air pressure or by suction. And actually, no air or CO2 touches the beer. But what it does, it pulls it through the beer like a siphon, effectively. And what that means is that you're getting the beer direct from the barrel. It's not coming into contact with CO2, so it's not going to be additionally carbonated. And it's not going to come in contact with the air until it arrives in your glass. So you're going to hopefully get the beer at its best.
Now, what's Camera's position on sparklers that are added on the tap to agitate the beer as it comes out?
Well, it's a funny one, is sparklers, because it's a little bit of a north-south divide. So much like in America, we have a north of England and we also have a south of England. I'm from the north, as any English listeners will be able to tell by my accent. So we tend to prefer our beer sparkled, which means that you get a frothier head, you get a kind of creamier texture to it. If you get a beer in London, if you get a beer in the south of England, they're much more likely to serve it without a sparkler, which means that you will get you'll get less of a creamy head. And it's kind of a classic Yorkshire thing, really, to have a sparkler on a beer. Personally, kind of putting the north-south divide aside for a second, personally, I think it depends on the beer. I personally really enjoy something like a porter or a stout served with a sparkler. But if I'm drinking a really kind of hoppy pale beer, then I don't really mind either way, and I quite like it without that tight creamy head. So in terms of Camera, we don't have a hard and fast rule. What we would normally do is we would either speak to the brewer, so we'd find out what the brewer would like to do with their beer. Most breweries will tell you serve this without a sparkler or serve it with a sparkler. And then the second thing is up to the customer. If the customer wants the beer sparkled, then that's their choice. They're paying the money, so they get to choose.
So you're standing firmly on the fence there.
I mean, I personally, I like sparklers. I like beers to be sparkled. But in terms of Camera's stance, yeah, it really depends on the brewer. So some breweries, you know, will have all of their beer non-sparkled, and they will tell the all of their pubs, you know, don't put a sparkler on this. Other breweries will tell them to put a sparkler on everything. So it's not so much us sitting on the fence. It's really it's done differently all over the UK, is what I'd say.
Now over here, typically what you'll see in a brew pub or a brewery is the cask sitting up on the bar and the bar or the beer being served via gravity. Is that done over there as well?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's again, that depends where you are. Quite often at beer festivals in the UK, so it's at some of the smaller camera beer festivals, beer will often be served by gravity, purely because for logistical reasons. So it's very difficult to have, you know, 300 hand pumps or 500 hand pumps for bar space, but you can quite easily have 300 beers or 500 beers racked at the back, which you can serve by gravity. So if you go to most pubs in the UK, they'll generally be served via a beer engine, which means they'll be served, you know, on hand pull. They'll be pulled through at the bar. It's fairly rare to see beers being served by gravity, but it does happen in some places. It depends where you are, really. But it's more often than not, 9 times out of 10, it will be served via a hand pull.
Now, I guess this is an area where probably the critics of camera, at least over here, the thing that they have the bone of contention with is that since these cask beers are not pushed out by CO2, and there is air coming into the cask that is not replaced by CO2, which would preserve the quality of the beer over time. Cask ale is a fairly short-lived product. I mean, it goes stale. So is that true?
I mean, it is true, yeah. So, I mean, the cask ale is a living product. It's a living thing. So, generally, once it's at its peak, once the pub has decided that it's ready to serve, realistically, you know, you're only going to get 2 to 4 days out of that cask of beer before it's going to start to not be at its best. Personally, I mean, you know, well, not even personally, but that in terms of where cameras stand on things, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, you can go and pick up a mass-produced loaf of bread, which will last for 3 weeks, but it doesn't mean it's going to taste better than a bread that you've got from the bakery down the road, which only lasts a day or 2 days. I don't think shelf life is the best way to look at something which you're going to eat or drink, personally. I think that if it tastes better and it lasts less time, I'd rather have something like that than something that will last for longer but doesn't taste as good. So yeah, it is a beer that's designed to be drank fresh. But a good real ale pub, a pub which has got a good throughput of beer, and a pub which has, you know, plenty of customers, and also a cellarman that knows what he's doing, you shouldn't be getting a bad pint, because generally a cask will come on and it'll be gone within a day or 2 days, and that is generally the case in a good cask beer pub. So yeah, it does definitely have a shorter shelf life, but if it's a good pub, then it doesn't last very long.
So let me play devil's advocate here. What's the sin of not putting a sort of CO2 or of putting a CO2 rebreather on the cask that is at atmospheric pressure, so you're not putting in additional carbon or carbonation, but you're just replacing the air in the cask with CO2 as it's being served in order to preserve the beer?
I think, well, to be honest, it's quite a technical one, but my understanding of it is that there's still going to be some dilution of that CO2. So you're still going to get some CO2, you know, unnatural forced carbonated CO2, whatever you want to call it, dissolving into the beer, even if it is just, you know, filling the headspace. You're still going to get some of that dissolving into it. That's kind of as I understand it. I think really what the issue is that it's a slippery slope, and it's very close to being forced carbonated. I think that's the real issue. Is at the moment it's very clear what's real ale, what isn't real ale, and, you know, putting carbonation into the headspace, which was previously filled with beer, is a little bit too close to kind of forced carbonating the beer. So it'd just be too difficult to have a definition of whether it's real or not at that point. And I think that's probably what the issue is. But yeah, it kind of goes back to the fact that, you know, what if that carbonation does get dissolved into the beer. That's probably not the most technical of answers, but I think that's probably the honest one.
That's a good one. I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, if it's exposed to a certain, you know, and somebody will write in telling me that I'm wrong, but that seems to make sense to me.
I'm sure there's a few things which I've got wrong throughout this. I'm not going to worry too much. So there's always somebody that knows more about brewing than myself, certainly. That's as I understand it anyway.
Now, along with the protecting the beer itself, a big part of the mission of Camera is protecting pubs. And I have a couple of pub-related questions here from Twitter. Neckbeard Beer says, why do the barkeeps at a pub in the UK think it's strange to smell the beer? They thought I was nuts. Well, I would, reading the Camera website, I would think that you wouldn't think it was nuts to smell your beer.
I mean, I wouldn't. No, I think it depends what pub you go into. And I think if you go into pubs which are known for their beer and which are known for the enjoyment of beer, or the range of beer, whether it's lots of real ales or whether it's in bottles of beer from around the world, I think that they wouldn't be surprised about you smelling your beer. And smelling beer is a massive part of tasting beer. You can't taste without smelling. So I don't think publicans proper beer bars would be surprised by that. But certainly if you go into one of the spit and sawdust boozers, then they might be a little bit surprised.
You talk a bit about the legislation that you're involved in lobbying for to protect the traditional pubs. What challenges are traditional pubs in the UK facing?
Well, there's a number of different things, really. I mean, as you sort of mentioned, Camera promote pubs in general, and we want to protect pubs. And there's a number of ways which pubs are under threat at the moment. One big thing for us is that actually pubs are not in their own use class from a planning permission point of view. So I'm not sure what the system is in America, but in the UK, certain buildings have planning permission. So if you've got that building and you want to convert it to something else, then you have to have planning permission. That basically means that people in the local area get to have a say on whether that should happen or not. At the moment, you can actually convert a pub into a supermarket, you can convert it into a shop or a restaurant, or you can actually demolish it without applying for planning permission. So it means that a valued local pub, which is being used by people, which is popular, which the community want to keep, they actually haven't. At the moment, they have no say in what happens to it in certain instances. And it's really dangerous because what it means is that actually you can have a pub which is really valued by a community and it can close and then be demolished the next day. And once a pub's gone, it's gone forever. So they very, very rarely become pubs again. It really is very damaging. We don't want any more pubs to be closing.
Wow. And why? Why is it? Why are pubs so important in the culture?
I mean, I think pubs are a massively important part of what makes Britain. I think when people visit Britain, the first thing they want to do is visit a British pub. It's ingrained in our culture, and that they're so important, to Britain. We did some research last year, which basically asked people what they felt about pubs, and they actually said that I think something like 67% of people said that a well-run community pub was as important to them as a community centre or a post office. I don't know if you have post offices in America, but it's a very important part of a village. And if you've got a village or a town or whatever, and the post office closes, that's a pretty big blow. In the same way that if a community centre closes, that's a big deal. So that's they're the kind of buildings that people put pubs next to. They're really, really important, and it's clear that people want to keep them, but we need to use them more.
Nicholas Vaught on Twitter asks, what steps can bars make to reinvigorate a sense of community, a bar as a meeting place with public discussion?
I think that's a really good question, and I think that there's lots of ways that they can do it. We did a thing last year which was called Community Pubs Month. And it's basically celebrating pubs which really get involved in their local community. So whether that's inviting them down, for discounted meals for senior citizens, or whether it's organising charity fundraisers, or whether it's something as simple as having kind of tea and coffee mornings. It doesn't all need to be about alcohol. Having tea or coffee mornings for mothers so they can bring their kids along and the kids can kind of watch a movie and they can have a tea or coffee. Opening your pub up earlier, perhaps not serving alcohol at that time, something like that. There's loads and loads of ways that pubs can develop and can get their local community involved. We've got some interesting examples in the UK where, you know, I mentioned local shops and how important they are to small villages and towns. There's instances in the UK where the local shop or the post office is closed, and the pub has actually filled that gap. So it's become a shop, and it started serving or selling kind of local produce, started selling milk, bread, these sort of things, and actually becoming a post office as well. So you can go to the pub, you can have a beer, and then you can buy a loaf of bread and some milk, and you can post a letter all in the same place. This is happening. It's not happening in every pub, but certainly there's examples out there. It's really important for any pub to know what their local customers want, to know what their local community want, and to react to that. It's the same as any business. If your local community is lots of families, then you know you need to be thinking about offering food, being open to having children there, whether that means having, you know, play area, safe play area, something like that. It's all about reacting to your local community and giving them what they need. Because if you do, then they will come.
Sort of in the spirit of the original term, which I think was public house, right? Isn't that where pub comes from?
That's correct. Yeah, it does come from public house.
I've got one more question or one more area that I want to get to. And it's inspired by a listener called Patrick. He says, I lived in Fort Worth, Texas for some time and sampled many American-style beers. I especially enjoy pale ales and remember Dale's Pale Ale fondly from my time in the States. I imagine my delight when I saw the beer for sale in a small homebrew/craft beer store in London. I bought a 12-ounce or 355-milliliter can and sampled the beer. Unfortunately, it was not what I remembered. The bitterness was much subdued, and those piney, resinous flavors from the American hops, which I love, were not there. I looked on the bottom of the can and discovered it was approaching 6 months in age. So what is the impression of American craft beer over there? And, you know, from a camera perspective and from a personal perspective, and is it well taken care of?
I think it is. I think American beer has got a fantastic reputation in the UK. And I think that actually, you know, some American craft beers which have made their way over here have actually, you know, got some new people into the beer market that perhaps wouldn't have been there before. You know, I'd much rather see somebody drinking a pint of Sierra Nevada Pale Ale or Brooklyn Lager, which are the kind of the big craft American craft brewers that have made their way over here. I'd much rather see them drinking that than drinking a mass-produced lager. Because if they're drinking that, they're drinking for flavor. They're drinking the beer because of how it tastes. And then they're much more likely to try, you know, something like a traditional real ale, which is obviously what Camera promotes. I think American beer and craft beer has had a huge influence in the UK. You know, there's brewers over here which are definitely influenced by America. You know, you've got breweries such as Magic Rock Brewery, to a certain extent the Colonel Brewery in London as well. And these are breweries which produce predominantly American style. So they produce a lot of pale ales, really hoppy pale ales, and then kind of stronger porters and imperial stouts and things like that. Beers which have been really popular in America and have been really important to the American craft beer scene. They're now being brewed more and more in the UK, and certainly they're inspiring brewers. I think it's for me, it's quite strange because when I went to America, I was just shocked by how little British beer was over there, and the stuff that does make its way over was probably not the stuff which we would call our best beer. As much as we're getting the, you know, the big breweries, so we're getting stuff from Lagunitas, we're getting things from Brooklyn, a little bit from kind of Stone, and you know, Dale's, as he mentioned there. These are still in the kind of specialist shops. If you go down your normal pub, you're probably not going to get an American craft beer, but that is starting to change. Some of the kind of big pub companies such as Wetherspoons and some other companies have started to really embrace American craft beer. So the likelihood of getting something, I don't know, something maybe like Goose Island IPA or even Lagunitas IPA to a certain extent is massively increased. So I think there is more people being exposed to it. And I think it does have a very good reputation. It's certainly inspiring brewers over here as well.
I would love to see more craft beers from over in your area over here as well. So maybe as time goes on, you know, things will flow back and forth equally.
I think absolutely. I mean, I think the beer world, you know, it's very easy to look at the beer world as being very segregated. But actually, you know, we've been swapping beer for hundreds of years, really. And you know, you look at it's quite interesting to see Britain. So you'll now see a British cask beer or a British bottle beer or whatever it is, and it will say American style IPA, which is quite an interesting thing, really, when you think about the history of that beer style. And you're looking, you know, it was a British beer style. It was obviously brewed, India Pale Ale, as I'm sure lots of your listeners will already know. So it was a beer that was brewed to kind of survive the long trip over to India to be drank by the British Raj. Then when the American craft beer movement started, they kind of picked up on this style and, you know, really ran with it. So you had beers which were massively hot but had this huge resinous pine flavour or kind of citrus flavour. And then English people kind of drank these beers and English brewers drank these beers and said, wow, you know, we should be producing something like this. So now you'll get English beers produced in England called American style IPA, which is quite interesting. But it's just for me, I like the fact that, beer is not a closed world. We're swapping ideas all the time.
Well, this has been fun, and I can't get away without thanking Stephen George, the listener who helped facilitate this whole thing.
No, absolutely. Thanks for putting us in touch, Stephen.
Yeah, and I hope one day to sample some real ales straight from the source. It's one of my goals to go over into England and to Britain and to find out what it's all about.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to come along to the Great British Beer Festival. That's the best place to try it.
Excellent. And by the way, when is that? Where is that?
That'll be August. So it's in London. I think next year it runs from the 12th to the 15th of August. But it's if people want to have a look, it's gbbf.org.uk.
Excellent. Thank you, Neil.
Brilliant. Nice speaking to you.
Well, thanks again to Neil. I learned a lot. It was a good conversation, especially that camera is more open-minded than a lot of us give them credit for being. So there you go. London in August sounds like a fun time. I bet there are a lot of amazing real ales and casks then. Maybe one day. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. And for a limited time this holiday season, check out our Jumbo Combo with our DVDs, all four of our DVDs, our bottle opener, and our brewer's logbook, all at one special low price. You can check out our shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And as I said at the beginning, thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link, especially during this busy, busy holiday season. We greatly appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are A Feast of Ice and Fire, the official Game of Thrones companion cookbook, and Craft Cocktails at Home, Offbeat Techniques, Contemporary Cloud... not clown pleasers, but the good, you know, contemporary crowd pleasers and classics hacked with science. Not saying that clowns wouldn't enjoy a nice craft cocktail. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what. So no worries there. Just click on their Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. It's time for lunch. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.